In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
This is a CBC podcast.
They're built differently than the rest of us, dancers. I don't just mean physically. I mean, when you use your body to express yourself, you move through the world in a different way. Benjamin Millepied was already locking himself in his bedroom to choreograph his own dances to old French songs when he was 7 years old. And he's carried that determined artistic spirit through his whole career, challenging the rigid conventions of the ballet world. His new film totally reimagines the classic opera Carmen and gives the title character the chance to dance right at the edge of danger. And you'll hear from Christy Lane Sinclair, who survived a whole lot of tough stuff in the years she was making her album Super Blood Wolf Moon. She'll talk about the freedom and the music she's found on the other side. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. As a dancer and choreographer, Benjamin Millepied has never really been one to sit on his heels. Yeah. See what we did there? Okay. He became a superstar in French and New York classical ballet, performing as a principal dancer on the biggest stages of our time. Benjamin then started the LA Dance Project, working to make dance more democratic and more diverse. And now he's applied his vision as a dancer and choreographer to directing his first feature film. It's called Carmen, and it's inspired by the famous opera, but Benjamin calls it a complete reimagining. His film is about a young woman who's running for her life across the Mexico-U.S. border, and an ex-Marine, an American ex-Marine, who's haunted by his experiences in combat, finds a purpose when he unexpectedly crosses her path. The movie has this dreamlike quality, not a lot of dialogue, but it's rich in images. And those images come into a beautiful focus when people start dancing, whether that's in the middle of the desert or a small nightclub in LA. Tom Power talked to Benjamin Millepied about Carmen and some of the milestones so far in his incredible career.
Welcome to Q.
Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you. People have been so excited to see this film for, I feel like, months now. Well, what's that been like for you, all this anticipation?
Well, I will admit I'm very eager to share the film with people, finally. It's quite a different process than making, you know, work in the live theater. So,
yeah, I'm sure it is. And it's Carmen. I mean, this is
yes,
a big story. I mean, you think about the adaptations of Carmen over the years, you know, in the 50s, the Carmen Jones film with Harry Belafonte, or the hip opera in 2001, the Carmen with Beyonce. What was it about Carmen that sort of met your imagination?
Well, it's, you know, it's an opera that that I saw, you know, multiple times as a child. I also had a kind of big impression of Carlos Saura's version of Carmen that I saw quite young. There was a lot of interest in flamenco in my family. And so when I was working on West Side Story, when I was dancing West Side Story in New York with New York City Ballet, and I was starting to create my first short films and was doing photography and was thinking about what story I would, you know, would be the right one to make a first film, I somehow Carmen came to mind, because it was still this idea to lean on something existing in classical and reinvent it. And then I think ultimately it was, the protagonist, this idea of this fearless, free woman, that something about that really spoke to me, and that is something personal, and also again from my family and the life of my mother, and you know, some that was definitely something that I was drawn to that had to do specifically with that.
Well, I want to talk more about that and sort of the parallels in your own life. But you mentioned that the reimagining of Carmen here, and I think that's a great way to put it. It's like, I sort of saw it as like, you know, when Coltrane plays like Rodgers and Hammerstein musicals, like it's still the musical, but it's so abstract and out there. It's more of an interpretation of it. I mean, yes. That's sort of how I saw this version of Carmen. But can you talk about that? Like, how you end, where you ended up taking the story to the Mexican border, specifically to protest to the present day, for, just for people who haven't seen it yet?
Yeah, I mean, I think compared to the opera, I wanted this, you know, this woman to be to be free and fearless, and not just to be this fantasy of what men think women should be, and this, you know, this thing that they want to possess, which is what happens in the original version. And it's also a woman who doesn't really love in the original Bizet, who can be loved, you know, and then this woman gets punished for her sins at the end of the film. So I wanted the opposite. I wanted to feel all of that magical, larger than life quality, but also give her an experience of love that was something positive, you know, and that's something that she can carry with her. And you know, as far as the Mexican border, like that, clearly, I mean, I've been living in America. I'm an immigrant as well for, you know, I've been living here for 29 years. And I was living in LA. And, you know, these were issues that I was confronted with in the news and that living with, and it felt like the right place to set the story, because it was something that was part of kind of my environment, and an environment that I was deeply in love with and also had mixed feelings about, because of, you know, the way, yeah, immigrants are treated.
You speak English good.
Well, I speak English well.
And many other social issues here in America.
Right, right. I mean, as an immigrant yourself, you're living in LA, you're close to the Mexico border there in California. I wanted to talk actually just about one of the very first scenes of the film, which is so striking. You see this middle-aged woman. We learn later she's Carmen's mother. She's dressed all in black. She's dancing flamenco on a square of plywood in the middle of the desert. How did you decide to start the film that way?
Gosh, now I don't know if I remember how, but I somehow had this opening in mind, and I knew exactly how I wanted it to take place. It was a very, very clear vision for the opening of the film, the sinuous road and the car driving down and the danger that she feels and her, this desire to be defiant and to dance in front of the danger. And it's really powerful, you know, it's really powerful because she basically knows what's going to happen. And she decides to dance in front of that and to be free. And we shot in 45 minutes. So I'm glad that it worked out as well as it did.
Well, I mean, it's interesting too, because I mean, the dancing is so, I mean, so powerful and so beautiful. And I should say that woman we're referring to is the legendary flamenco dancer Marina Tamayo. But it's worth mentioning that the two main characters are Carmen, played by Melissa Barrera, and the Marine Aiden, the ex-Marine Aiden, is played by Paul Mezcal.
Are you a soldier?
Marine.
My name is Carmen.
Neither of which are classically trained dancers, which seems very strange to me. But then when I started to do research for this interview, you often work with dancers who have no training or like very, very little training, right?
Yeah, and I think that was also the idea. I wanted a man to play a Marine who didn't have the ability to suddenly break into dance moves. You know, I wanted it to be realistic, and I wanted to dance like a Marine. So, you know, it's about stretching, obviously stretching the, you know, pushing the boundary to him to be able to move, but still feels like it's the character. And it keeps you fully into the story, and you're not pulled out of it, because suddenly it's completely unrealistic that this guy had a perfect, you know, dance technique. And she has this insane ability to dance without taking dance or having taken dance lessons. And I still to this day don't really know how she does it. But she actually performs some of the dances when she's dancing with other professional dancers with more freedom and ease than the professional dancers themselves, which is nuts.
What do you make of that? Like, what do you? I mean, you're like one of the more like esteemed dancers and choreographers of our time. Like, do you like working with non dancers?
I think it's I love to have restraints, to have constraints. I mean, to be creative, to find ways to make things work when, you know, it's so I think in this sense here, like they need to feel like real people. And she obviously was a dancer in the story, but he's not. And so I really thought it was an advantage to doing this movie, you know, telling the story the right way.
How was Paul? I've got to meet Paul Mescal. Like, how was he when, I mean, he dances and sings in this film. How much did you know about his skills going in? Tell me about working with him on that.
Well, I knew he could sing, and I knew he was a physical kind of actor. You could see it in all people. I mean, even with just somebody who played rugby and sports, and you know, I just from talking to him, I had no fear that I would be able to get him to move, and I would adapt, and it would feel right. And you know, I didn't want a man who felt like a pretty boy. I wanted a real Marine who's actually gone through war and come back and whose life is severely changed forever, you know, and lives it like a ghost, you know. And so he really was able to do that, and so easily. It was really fantastic, you know. There's so much inner life to his character with so little dialogue.
I wanted to talk a little bit about the way older women are sort of celebrated in this film. I mean, there's Carmen's mother, who's played again by Marina Tamayo. Her best friend is played by Rossi De Palma. Talk to me a little bit about the way you wanted to portray or value older women in this film.
You know, it's funny you mentioned it, because I mean, you know, I wasn't thinking, oh, I need to portray older women. I mean, I was like, this is Carmen's mother. She opens the film, and I remember I had someone who was working on the film early on, who said to me, "Why would you start?" And this was a woman, actually. She said, "Why would you start the movie with an old woman?" You know, and it was really struck by the comment, and I thought, it didn't even occur to me that, like, I'm just starting with like a person, and like that person, happens to be older, happens to be a woman, and it's really amazing. And it's filled with beauty and emotion. And it just never was something that would occur to me that I'm doing something, you know, that's special here. People, you know, I'm interested in people, old and young.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, and yeah, maybe they are, I'm celebrating them, and they should be celebrated.
Well, I guess that's what stuck out to us when we were watching it, we were talking about it, was that, you know, it's not something you see quite often in these films.
That's wild. That's wild. That's something that needs to be pointed out, you know. But it's probably true. It's probably true.
You mentioned earlier that this was inspired by the story of your mother. How do you mean?
Well, I think, you know, I think I've witnessed my mother going through life and relationships, and that was also kind of the point, is that I wanted Carmen to have this experience with this man who was special, who was deeply a good person, and to have, while like celebrating her freedom throughout, like being driven by it and her integrity, you know, could have meet someone who kind of would affect her and change her life forever and her relationships forever. And so I think there is something about witnessing as a kid, you know, men who want to possess women, and not, it's really, celebrate freedom as a thing of beauty, you know, a thing of beauty that is enriching and liberating in a relationship.
I wanted to talk a little bit about sort of dance and sort of your beginnings in it. I mean, this movie in so many ways is a movie of people dancing from their hearts. You know, this is not people dancing in a theater or in, you know, in gowns and in tuxes. I wonder if you could take me back to the time you spent in Senegal when you were a really little kid, and a little bit about how dance came into your life.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's this incredible luck I had where, you know, dance in poor countries is, you know, the first thing that you learn how to walk, you learn how to dance, and you learn how to respond to music. And it's a thing of joy, and you find such incredible joy in places that are really poor and are really difficult. And so my experience with dance was the experience of a child growing up in Africa, because we weren't, my mother sent me to didn't send me to a white school when we were in Senegal. I was really sent to a black school. I was the only white kid. So we didn't live in the neighborhood that was just for white people. We had, our neighbor was family was the Doudou Niane Rose family, which is the most famous drumming family of Senegal, which is, 10 wife and 40 children who all drum and dance.
Yeah.
So I just grew up with this experience of like, you hear music, you hear drumming. And it's a really wonderful thing to grow up into as a celebration of like being a human being, being a human being and celebrating life and yourself and each other.
I understand. So people like, I mean, maybe not people like me, because I come from a place with like a lot of traditional dance in it. But like, for a lot of people, dance would be something they would go to. They would go to. They would go. I think your mom was a dance teacher, right? Like,
yeah.
Would go to a class, and there'd be a bar, and there'd be these are the moments. This is the hour a week that you dance.
Yeah.
But when you're in Senegal, you see, dance is a part of all of life.
Absolutely. Dance and music are just part of life, and it's a source of joy. It's a source of expression. It's also a source of tough expressions, and I think it's such an asset to have something like that in life where you can express yourself in a way that's intimate with yourself.
But yet you wanted to go down the classical route when it came to your own dance life.
Well, I did African growing up. I did modern, and then I saw Gene Kelly and Fred Astaire, and then Baryshnikov, and then suddenly I was an athletic kid, and I thought, wow, like who's this man who can fly and seem filled with stories, and I was really inspired. Seeing White Nights was a turning point for me.
One pirouette, 1 ruble. Two pirouettes, 2 rubles, and on. You're betting, man?
Yeah, what do I get if you lose?
It's a good question. They took my money. I watch?
I heard you used to make up dances in your room when you were a kid.
I grew up, dance, like making dance was like my child today makes paintings. Actually, my child... One of my kids also makes dances already.
Oh, really?
Yeah. My daughter. Yeah. But I would lock myself in my room, like close myself in my room and pick a song and choreograph it. And I was, six, seven. I would do that. When I would go on stage, I would choreograph what I was dancing always.
Well, give me a song that you used to use choreograph when you were a kid.
I mean, I think most famously, like, there's a Léo Ferré song called Ainsi que les hommes vivent, which is a text by Aragon. Moi qui me traîne et m'éparpille, et mon ombre se déshabille dans les bras semblables des filles où j'ai cru trouver un pays. Which is a really dark, gorgeous song, most beautiful poetry, which no seven-year-old listens to. was the song, I remember choreographing that song. But that's a particular one I remember thinking, what a really an odd kid I was to have that as my song to dance to. Est-ce ainsi que les hommes vivent, et leur baiser
au loin les suive. How does it make you feel to see your kid making up their own dances now as a little kid?
It's a very strange thing with my daughter that feels like she's inherited kind of the dance DNA from me somehow, where I find her perform like doing steps that she's never seen that I've danced on stage for decades. It's a really funny thing, and probably she'll do nothing to do with the arts, but it's a really interesting thing to see something like that talent, like this kind of talent being passed on somehow.
You mentioned that it was Gene Kelly and Baryshnikov were these sort of major formative influences on you when you were a kid. I mean, you go on to have this incredible accomplishment filled life in dance, you know, the principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. You got to work, you got to choreograph Baryshnikov, right?
I did, which was a really stunning opportunity he gave me.
Did you tell him what he meant to you?
Oh, of course he knows. Yeah, of course he knows. He knows, absolutely. And I mean, he's a friend and also, you know, he actually is funny because he saw a film. You know, I think the first thing he saw of mine was a film I did. It was my first film, which was when I danced for the Streets of New York.
Yeah.
And he liked the film. And that's why he decided to, you know what, do a solo with me, work with me. Let's do something together. Yeah. I was 28.
I'm like a 9-minute walk here. He was in here not that long ago, maybe about a year ago, 2 years ago, for his photography exhibit. And we realized while we were sitting here that we are a 10-minute walk away from where he did the Defection in Toronto.
Wow.
Yeah.
Wow, what a night. I've had him walk me through that night, I think once, twice. I was lucky to hear it, what that night was like. Yeah, that's wild. Like we have no idea. Can you imagine leaving the Soviet Union and just kind of going on tour and finishing a performance and kind of walking out and never going back? I mean, it's unbelievable what that whole story is. It's just, what a remarkable artist.
That was the first part of Tom Power's conversation with Benjamin Millepied. You are going to hear more of Tom Power's conversation with one of the most acclaimed dancers and choreographers of our time, Benjamin Millepied. Benjamin has never been one to shy away from fighting for what he believes in. Coming up after the break, Tom asks him about the price he paid to try to make change happen at one of the cornerstone institutions of dance. More Benjamin Millepied coming up.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
I long to see an audience that is really one that resembles Paris, you know, that is not elitist, but rather more diverse, and that also means the company also has to be that way.
That's Benjamin Millepied. He was speaking to the media in 2014 when he took the job of director of dance for the prestigious and very traditional Paris Opera Ballet. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. You're about to hear the rest of Tom's conversation with Benjamin Millepied, who was really hoping to make some change at the Paris Opera Ballet, moving away from the literal ballet blanc, where everyone had to look homogenous and white. After all, he had already started his own company, the LA Dance Project, which was diverse and all about innovation. Tom wanted to ask him about that time and what happened when he tried to shake up a very stodgy institution. Here's the rest of Tom Power's conversation with Benjamin Millepied.
I approach everything from an artistic inspiration and desire and bring people together and all that. And then I think because dance, I really so believe in dance is the celebration of being alive, of dance is interesting when a person can be completely themselves and make choices that are singular to them. And it's to celebrate the beauty in each and every one of us. And so the moment you believe that, and you, even if you're working with the quarter ballet of a large company, you want people that are different and that look different and have something different, a different narrative to tell you. And that's what makes a quarter ballet beautiful to watch. It's the sum of all these different energies. And so, of course, with dance, you celebrate. If you celebrate that, you celebrate, you know, the diversity. And I had huge issues at Paris in 2016, 2015, with, you know, this idea that the company should be all white, you know, which is what I was told when I got there. Essentially, it was like, you know, that's the whole point, is that everybody here should be white, so everybody looks the same. So it's striking anybody that looks different is going to create attention and ruin this thing of beauty that is homogenous. And I was like, we're going to have a problem. Yeah. This isn't going to work out. This is not how it goes. And so I confronted these issues because they're in my blood. There's no way I couldn't agree with that. There's no way in hell I could agree with that. And so, years later, now it's 2023 and the new director gets hired. And what do we talk about to him is like, look at, what a different world it is now. And what are you going to do to continue what, was started in 2015? And so it's great to see that, you create change, and sometimes it's hard. It's not well received. I got no support at the time in Paris for making change like this.
I understand what you mean. Like in 2023, it's like, how do we look at the success of this thing? How do we keep this going? Whereas you came under a lot of fire for making those changes.
I got only fire. No one supported me in the press to have changed the blackface dances with the children in Bayadere there. No one had supported me for not painting the black girls in white in Swan Lake, so at the time. So, it was tough, but it was necessary. And it shows you that change takes time and then it's not a straight line, and then things eventually happen. And I think with LA, I just had the funny issue because we just performed the Romeo and Juliet in Paris, and we're doing it all over. But, my idea was that I can't represent, why would I represent Romeo and Juliet just as a man and a woman, just because that's the history, when my dancers in my company all have, different experiences of love, and some interested in men and women, and some both. And why not have shows with two women and shows with two men, and actually show a realistic representation of love with something that we're not used to seeing? And so that's what we do. And it's really just out of respect, and representing love as it exists today in the world. I mean, I have children and new generations, and people have a completely different experience of what relationships are like and marriage is like, and, or should be like. And so it was interesting because it created so much conversation in Paris, this thing that we presented, because that's where we premiered it. And you could see parents going with their children and kids that were happy that this was taking place, and parents that were having problems, and men who came with their wife and left the theater. And, it was like,
people walked out.
Yeah. There was people who'd walk out, but but the bottom line is it was a 3,500 seat theater. We did 11 shows. They were all sold out. 35,000 people came to see it. And dance can be political. I just think, like anything, it needs to be, can't be didactic. It has to be, you have to be true, and you have to let people walk away and do their own path in terms of like thinking and change and actually making a difference in their lives and the lives of others.
We had Misty Copeland on the show last year. Mm-hmm. For people who are listening to this who don't know, Misty is the first black female principal dancer for the American Ballet Theater. And I wanted to play you something she had to say about performing in Swan Lake. Just take a listen to this.
Whereas we've been told that we will ruin the aesthetic of these ballet blanc ballets, where it should just be white bodies wearing white tulle. Anything other than that will take from the integrity of the choreography and vision. There's all of that on my shoulders.
How much does that resonate with your own experience of the traditional ballet world?
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly what I experienced at Paris Opera. I was on stage. I remember it was a dress rehearsal of Swan Lake, and there were maybe two girls of color in the whole corps de ballet, one of them which I managed to hire with great difficulty, because you don't actually get to choose alone who's hired at the opera when you're the director. It's a committee. And I couldn't see them on stage. I couldn't point them out. I'm like, where are they? And they were basically had so much white makeup on that they were white girls, And so I ran backstage during the performance, and I went to talk to the makeup department and talk to the girls. And it was tricky because you could tell that the girls, these two girls of color, didn't know how to even feel about it, because they were like, they've made me feel bad about the color of my skin my whole childhood. It was a really brutal confrontation where the press essentially was saying, what is he doing? This is the tradition, you know? Yeah.
And it must be gratifying to see that, change now. As much as it is frustrating that it took so long, it must be gratifying to see that change.
No, it totally is gratifying. And it's also gratifying in how, what people remember of my position and how, because now I'm starting a ballet dance project in Paris. I'm starting Paris Dance Project, which is not a company, but a large education project for the suburbs of Paris and also a choreography program and so forth. But like, because I'm going to the outskirts of Paris and the banlieues and these neighborhoods, and I'm starting, you know, programs, and people welcome you arms open, and it just really feels like, you know, it's so, I feel so good that I was just stuck to my guns, you know, at the time. The payback is really incredible, really, today.
So speaking of sort of like the aberration of tradition, I can't not talk to you briefly about Black Swan. You know, you make this big leap into film in 2010, Darren Aronofsky's film Black Swan, which you choreographed and also danced in with your now wife, Natalie Portman. As a classical dancer, you must have known Swan Lake inside and out. You know, it must be so deeply in your blood. What was it like to have to experiment, skew it to something sinister for Darren Aronofsky?
Yeah, you know, this is Darren's vision. Darren's vision, you know, tends to go to dark places. And I mean, my role was to get Natalie to be credible on screen as a ballerina in Swan Lake, which was really reaching for the impossible. It was really Darren. The great thing is Darren knew. I didn't have to tell Darren that he needed to put the camera close to Natalie and let the camera move. Like he intuitively knew that the way to make this work was to move with her and to move handheld.
Not so controlled. Seduces. Not just the prince, but the court, the audience, the entire world. Come on. The fuerte are like a spider spinning a web. Attack it. Attack it. Come on.
I would rehearse with her, and I would, you know, gag the camera and move with her and just try different things. And I got a sense of this, how great it was to add this movement to the dancer and the immersive quality that it gave and like the credibility that it, the fluidity that it brought to, particularly to someone who was not a prima ballerina, you know? So for me, like that was the main focus. I was lucky to actually partner her, which was a good thing because with my partnering, I could only enhance her credibility and, you know, got to have this great love story and that began. So, yeah.
Yeah, I guess that's a nice part of it too, now that you're, but it goes back to what we were talking about earlier with Carmen, the idea that like, I mean, I never thought about that. That's another example of, I mean, a more extreme example of you having to work with someone who, as you mentioned, is not a prima ballerina.
Yeah.
And to help them take on one of the most, from my understanding of talking to dancers I know, one of the more challenging roles that anyone can take on in classical dance. I mean, that's not a, I don't know what my question is, except to say that's not easy, you know?
Yeah. No, it's not. It's not.
Before I let you go now, and I know we have to run. Okay. I'm going to tell you something about my own sort of experience with dance, that when I came into this show, which is like this, you know, this Canadian arts and entertainment show, I came into the show as a musician and I had, you know, toured and played music. And of all the kind of art forms we talk about on this show, you know, film and TV and visual art and all that stuff, dance was the discipline that I knew the least about. I had kind of no real experience with either doing it or going to see it. I'll tell you this, it is the art form that I am the most moved by all of the things that I didn't know about, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I remember knowing nothing about it, and then the National Ballet here in Canada got me a ticket to Swan Lake, and they were like, go see Swan Lake. And I was like, I've never had an experience like that before, where I was just like, I get it. This is beautiful. I'm so, like, emotionally moved by everything, and I felt so kind of dumb that I hadn't taken it in beforehand. This is a basic question, but I am curious to hear your answer. What do you feel now to this day when you watch dance, when you watch great dance?
Wow. Well, first of all, I'm so happy to hear that you've had that kind of response to it. And I think that can be the case for people who have never experienced it and to see it and to completely get it. When I see good dance, I think that's layered with human emotion, but also like things that are complex underneath the surface. It makes me, it fills me with, you know, fills me with joy. It really does. It fills me it enriches me, you know, And that's, it's really a gift, especially when, you know, things are unexpected. When you see you witness things that are unexpected and that have a quality of grace. We so people don't pay attention to. There's just a lack of observation of each other in life in general, right? You walk through life, and today you walk through life on your phone, and you're just sort of, there's a kind of zombie quality. And like in dance, you're facing people who are moving in space without speaking, and you're observing them and you're learning from them. And by chance, you're seeing a good work of art, which is right, teaching you something about yourself as well.
Well, that's such a beautiful answer, again, especially in this kind of isolated world that we're living in right now. Benjamin, congratulations on Carmen, and thanks so much for your time today. I really love getting a chance to talk to you.
You're so welcome. Thank you. It was an awesome interview.
That was Tom Powers' awesome interview with Benjamin Millepied. I agree, Benjamin, it was. Benjamin's new feature film, his first as a director, is called Carmen. It's a musical and a drama with some beautiful dance. It is in theaters now. Tom Power spoke to him from New York. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. You are listening to Q. Christy Lane Sinclair spent the last 5 years working on her new album. And in that time, she went through some of the hardest things a person can go through. She survived domestic abuse. She developed PTSD as a result. She felt depressed. And as you'll hear in a second, things were looking pretty bleak. Until one day, things started to look up. And Christy began writing an album all about her experience. It's called Super Blood Wolf Moon. She joined Tom Power to talk about making it and to share a song.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm trying to figure out, I think you and I first met at, I think it was Folk Alliance. Was it in New Orleans?
Yeah. I think I was like, hey, dude, can I have directions? I'm like, also, I know you're Tom Power. but where am I supposed to be right now?
Yeah, I remember that.
I made you my handler.
I remember that. And I think we hung out again at the CBC Music Festival.
Yes. Yes, with Tribe.
With Tribe.
Yeah.
Nice to see you. Nice.
Yeah, you too.
Congratulations on the album.
Thank you.
How are you feeling now that it's out?
I feel good. It was like... It's been like brewing for, you know, it says like 3 years, but it was more like 5 years, you know, like I was writing this album for so long and then it got to a point to record it. And I was just like, it's just not done. My whole life changed. And I kind of just like took a break and kept writing and it kind of came out the way it did.
How are you feeling now that it's finally out there?
I feel good. I feel relieved. I mean, there's a lot of stuff. I didn't like... choose to write the songs, you know, the songs kind of choose you sometimes. And that was definitely the case with this album. There was a lot of songs I didn't think I'd ever release. But now that they're out, it's kind of like a weight has been lifted. And, you know, it's yours to carry now, Tom.
Okay, I'm here. I'm ready. I got my grocery bags.
You look
good.
Tough.
I'm ready.
Yeah, I've lots of baggage.
I've been working out.
Okay.
I can carry it.
Okay.
I haven't been working out. all right, so... as much as you're comfortable with, as much as you want to do here, talk to me a little bit about sort of like the story of this album.
I guess I'll just like rip part of it off, like the Band-Aid it is. And so it's halfway done. And then I experienced domestic abuse, which turned into PTSD, which kind of turned into me being off work for like 2 years and going through it. Not only the mental and like physical stuff that happens with it, but just as like having a voice to put to it. I mean, like everybody kind of thinks it's like the scene from Law and Order, you know, like, you know, the woman's scared and alone and she has to get clothes from a bin and all she needs is like a hug. And that's just not PTSD. It's fight or flight, but it's a lot of fight and it's a lot of like, you know, going through stuff. And I wanted to reflect that in songs for myself. And it ended up being a huge part of this album.
You experienced some domestic abuse. I'm so sorry. And then, you know, you experienced PTSD from that. And then it's not what people think it is. It's not, you know, what it is on TV versus some shaking person. Like you said, on Law and Order, just gets a hug and that's all they need. It's so much more complicated than that. And you started writing songs to try and process that. Is that right?
Well, I mean, yeah. And just like, I was trying to do like a true account and initially it was just for myself, but like a lot of it was, you know, you don't do everything right. It's not just a number of counselor sessions. I think you have to do, you know, everything wrong 53 times. Yeah. And then sometimes on 54, you know, things get better. And if there was a moral to this album, if there was a story, it's like one day I sat up on the side of my bed and was like, you know what, I'm going to go for a walk.
Yeah.
And that was huge.
Yeah.
But it happened. And you couldn't tell me a year before that was going to happen.
Yeah.
It's a lot.
Yeah.
I mean,
how are you feeling?
Well, it's still going, you know. I had to kind of relearn how to play guitar and live my life. And, you know, it's pretty, part of it can be like a bit of a gift as well. I mean, I feel super, super alive. And I don't give any Fs, so that feels pretty freeing, actually.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
yeah, once you come to the other side of something like that,
right?
It's
freeing. I'm just like, let's go, girl.
Yeah.
Come on, Tom. Come at me.
I don't want to. I'm here. I'm just here like you.
In a good way.
I'll come at you in a good way all the time. I was reading the quote from you about this record. And it said, I don't want my identity to be that of a victim.
Not to victimize victimhood.
Yeah.
But it's more of a survivor. I mean, like, you know, you kind of come to the other side of it. And, you know, and the song Break that we're gonna listen to was a lot of the music video. I went to Haida Gwaii quarantine for 2 weeks to make this video.
Is that your home?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my homeland.
Mm-hmm. How was that? Well, how was the experience of going to Haida Gwaii during quarantine to shoot the video?
It was amazing because I hadn't been in a room with my family and I quarantined. And this was the first kind of ceremony kind of thing that we did. And the video felt very much like ceremony. My aunts were there and they were a huge part of healing me from like PTSD because, you know, I kind of got, you know, everyone's just like, you know, you should like go for a walk around the block. And like, yeah. I'm like, okay, cool. Mm-hmm. But,
they were able to help in a more fulsome way.
Well, just like sit down. They're like, we're not worried about you. You're like a Haida woman. We mix trauma with our shreddies for breakfast. Like you got this. And just that kind of attitude of like, we're tough and, you know, surviving doesn't mean like the beaten down, like, you know, shell of a person.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that.
Yeah.
You're who you are, like, and it comes out in the wash. It's just a long wash.
Yeah.
on the really heavily soiled cycle.
It's on the last. It's on the last knob.
It's
you
like
have to turn.
180
you gotta go.
Minutes.
You're not
and
getting.
And then it's like.
And you think your house is gonna fall down because. Like,
no. Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Totally. Or I'll burn it to the ground. Whatever.
Exactly.
Whatever the mood I was in that day.
You're gonna set up a song from the album before we play the song and I get you to set it up. Tell me about writing Break. Where did the song come from?
Break is kind of the truest account of, you know, what happened and what kind of transpired. I'm not really usually like a literal writer, but, you know, it's about the fight. It's the fight scene. And it's featuring my late great friend, Kelly Frazier, who was supposed to be, who really, really wanted to record on this album. And that didn't get to be able to be happening.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I requested some beats from her producer, some throat singing. And the first one I got was this one, and it was the perfect BPM. It just clicked in. It belonged there. It was just like, you know, a visit for my sister. And, you know, she had PTSD too.
Yeah.
And I didn't actually know it. And she didn't know about me either. So I feel like this is like our last, you know, our last jam.
And your last sort of meeting with one another.
Yeah.
In some ways, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, and it's so common, the more people I talk to about it. So it's like all the women's voices at the end is like kind of like all of us and ancestrally and otherwise. And yeah, it just turned into like a super woman power banger. And yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited. I'm excited for people to hear it. I'm so happy you came in.
Me too.
Thanks for doing this. And I really appreciate you talking to me about all this stuff. I really do.
Yeah. No, I would... Yeah, I would only talk to you about it.
Oh, you're sweet. Thanks. It means a lot to me. You want to introduce the song? You want to say, hey, my name is, and here's the song?
Yeah.
Come on. I'm ready. I'm excited for this.
Are you ready?
You got it?
Okay.
We're good. Okay. I'm ready.
Hey, I'm Christy Lane Sinclair,
woo!
And you are about to listen to Break from my new album, Super Blood Wolf Moon.
That was Break by Christy Lane Sinclair. Before that, you heard her conversation with Tom Power. Christy Lane Sinclair's new album, Super Blood Wolf Moon, is out everywhere now. And that's it for Q today. Tomorrow on the show, as if making an album wasn't enough, Kid Koala created an entire board game to go with it. This is just the latest sonic and physical mashup that he's been so well known for. Kid Koala drops by Q to talk about going the extra mile and why he has always been a turntable maximalist. I'm Talia Schlanger, sitting in for Tom Power. See you next time.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.